Hey, Emmeline Godfrey. Hello, how are you?
Hello.
Hi.
I'm
So,
good, yeah. Just sort of doing lots of bits and pieces during the lockdown. I've been so busy with like writing and researching, and literally I've not had a chance to be bored yet, so that would be good to be bored at some point.
this I'm sharing the screen now of which is the first book? The first book is Masculinity, Crime and Self-Defense in Victorian Literature, isn't it? That's
Yeah,
the first.
that's the first one. A bit of a
And then
mouthful.
the second one is Femininity, Crime and Self-Defense in Victorian Literature and Society. And was the I mean, I read the masculinity one first, and that came out, was that 2012? Or there seem to
That
be
was
different dates on different editions.
2010, and then the next one was 2013.
Okay, 2007. So that's, I think it's an absolutely fascinating and brilliant book. Was it first of all, was this a project about masculinity and self-defense, or was it about Victorian literature, or what was the main kind of thing that drove this first project in self-defense?
I think one thing that really interested me was I'd just done a self-defense course about 2001, and I kind of thought to myself, how did the Victorians defend themselves? For instance, women who are walking in the streets of London, what kind of methods they use as opposed to nowadays, what kind of tips were offered as well. Now, for instance, people sort of say, don't put your name on your t-shirt or things like that, so people can identify you and call you by your names, especially with kids. Don't put the names in the t-shirts and things. That's one thing we were kind of learning, tips like that, but also, sort of walking the middle of the road, personal attack alarms. And I kind of wondered what the sort of 19th century kind of advice that women and indeed men were given. And that did occur, that men were advised, walk in the middle of the pavement, specifically during the garrotting panics of the 1850s, where there was this fear that you could be strangled in the street and then sort of your money could be rifled out, taken out of your pockets. So if you walked in the middle of the pavement as much as possible, you had, well, hopefully not being run over by a car or something, a lot of these, the Victorian roads were extremely chaotic and there was lots of traffic everywhere. So it's kind of it gave people a bit bigger visibility, walking in the middle of the road. But also, how did people negotiate traffic? That's another point too, because one of the things I was looking at were, sort of women's personal testimonies of these really odd encounters they would have whilst crossing the road, such as, for instance, men coming up to them and whispering really weird things at them. And then sort of, oh, did that really happen? And that would come up quite a lot, and how women were meant to react to that kind of interaction.
Okay.
So all these kind of sort of thoughts were sort of flitting around in my head at the time. And I thought, it'd be really interesting actually just to kind of make a larger study of this, and also to see how these attitudes, solutions and also problems as well were reflected, in novels and plays at the time. And there's a lovely set of plays actually in the British Library about garrotting. So, you've got people who are really scared in Highgate and they don't want to go out. I don't know why they set it in Highgate, but there's a man who's very scared and he arms himself to the teeth with all kinds of weapons and he ends up injuring himself with all the weapons because he's just the sort of going out completely tooled up, sort of expecting some kind of confrontation when he does eventually leave the house. So you have all these kind of in a sense, almost kind of hysterical sort of representations of fear as well, but then you've got more sensible ideas too in parallel with that.
So you're first of all a literary scholar or
It's
a
weird. I kind
historian,
of
or
fell into that.
are you, so what how would you kind of identify your interests, your academic interests? Are they literary, are they cultural, are they historical, or
I think more history, and it's quite weird because doing the whole PhD, and then eventually my supervisor said to me about 2 months before handing it in, she said, this is an English literature PhD, you do need to do a literature review at the beginning of, and I thought, oh no. So I had to go off and panic a bit and research all this theory and kind of put it in the front of my PhD, because I kind of treated it mainly as a history PhD with, literature and poems in there as well. So yeah, my background's mainly history. I did an undergrad, and it's called Russian Studies, Russian Joint Studies at the LSE. So mainly a sort of history, kind of, yeah, I suppose a history background, but I've always been interested in novels and poetry as well, as sort of sources of how people felt, but also as ways that people could communicate advice to each other on, for instance, self-defense.
So your the masculinity and femininity books, you look at in literature, you look at newspaper stories about about crime and about the kind of moral panics that animated Victorian society. And I so when I first read the masculinity book, is the one I read first, and I read reviews of it, the reviews that had been published at the time. And a couple of reviewers seemed to have been quite confused about what kind of a book it was they were reading. I mean, for me,
and I
thought, how odd, because like it to me, it was really clear that you were doing a kind of cultural history. You were looking at what were the moral panics and what were the ideological concerns that might have been filtering around in the heads of journalists and writers. And so you kind of identify fears of colonial subject. So the very word thug comes from the Indian cult thuggee, and this was a cult who would not just like rob Westerners. They kind of gained glory from killing them, didn't they? So that was something to worry about if you're an imperialist or a colonialist in India. And then hooligans, which comes from the Irish surname, and so like hooligans being kind of immigrant Irish workers in metropolitan cities like London, and these kind of general anxieties that sometimes coalesced into moral panics around like garrotting. In garrotting, one person would come up behind someone and put something around their neck, and the other person would rifle their pockets. And I thought that it was a really brilliant and far-reaching survey of the kind of measurement of the psyche throughout the 19th century into the early Edwardian period.
There's a shift as well in attitudes. So in the beginning of the 19th century, you know, everyday violent approaches, you know, to a self-defense situation were more acceptable. So you had, for instance, dueling as a way of resolving disputes over honor and reputation. By the 1850s, you know, that wasn't really acceptable anymore. And then also by the 1850s, you know, you had the garrotting panics where people had all these crazy weapons that they'd manufactured in their sheds, and they'd actually sort of send them into the newspaper editors and say, I've created this crazy multiplex, you know, set of knives and a knuckle duster. But then by the end of the 19th century, that was less kind of acceptable as well. That was kind of seen as, you know, too much of a kind of overkill response to an everyday potentially.
So you measure the shift, don't you, between the attitudes. So at a certain point in time, people become really obsessed with like wearing armor. So they'll have like really high, they'll almost have like chainmail ruffs on, and then that becomes, over time, that becomes unfashionable, and it becomes kind of represented as a little bit scaredy cat, and weapons are regarded as kind of a bit uncool, although there is a lot of gun carrying at certain points, because guns weren't really legislated for, were they? But there's a shift, and ultimately I think your study culminates with the idea of almost like the Sherlock Holmesian gentleman, with that ethos of not carrying a weapon, not using a weapon because it's un-British or un-English, but being able to dispatch a hooligan, a ruffian, a thug, someone, an oik who might want to rob you, but to do that with a certain class-based finesse.
Exactly.
So Sherlock Holmes is your ultimate like paradigm case character.
Well, especially that confrontation with Professor Moriarty at the Reichenbach Falls in Switzerland. You know, the story, The Adventure of the Empty House, was published in 1903, and that was Conan Doyle bringing Sherlock Holmes back using martial arts. So I was so excited because I was sort of going through novels, seeing if I could find some self-defense scenarios, and then I saw that and I almost fell off my chair. This is brilliant. This has got to be a chapter on Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
But I just love that scene there, because you've got the cascading, the waterfalls, and when you actually go to the Reichenbach Falls, even though half the water was siphoned off for hydroelectrics, you still have the impression that it's such a cold and inhospitable place. So if you imagine that the water at its full force, with these two men, you know, trying to defend their own lives, trying to protect themselves, and who's going to be thrown over the edge, and this is really called moment of tension. So, you know, when you go to the Reichenbach Falls, you can really imagine that. And I, so I think there's a mixture of the sublime, and there's also martial arts in there as well. Yes. And, you know, and Victorian gentlemen. And it's just such a great scene.
Because this is the famous kind of reference to what Conan Doyle calls Baritsu.
Yeah.
But it is, of course, to Bartitsu. And it's really, I mean, I think you're quite connected with the Bartitsu Society, the people who have researched and reconstructed it.
I mean, Tony Wolfe, for instance, he's actually writing a new book on Spring Hill Jack at the moment. So that's one of his new things. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Spring Hill Jack. You know, that was something that terrified me when I was a child. I had one of those like Mysteries of the World books. And the Victorian fear of Spring-Heeled Jack was a kind of mythical character who had like goat-like feet and would jump around and do...
breathe fire and all of that.
that was a terrifying character for me when I was a child. But I can see how the Victorians would be worried about such a
character. Also, like, one of the things I mentioned, because there's a new book I'm working on at the moment, and some other childhood fears that come up from early in the 19th century, sort of, they're these suffragettes, and they talk about being scared of Jack the Ripper, they talk about being scared of Mr. Punch, and worrying that these figures would be underneath their beds, and then by the time in the early 1900s, you know, they've got to go out at night and they've got to, you know, try and print the suffragette through the night, the suffragette, a magazine that was made illegal during the suffrage campaign. And they had to go out and they had to try and get this to print. And so they, in a sense, had to confront their own demons, the things that they were scared of as children, you know, things that lurk in the dark. So you had these examples of women who would say, you know, I was coming back in the early hours of the morning, having printed off the suffragette edition that said raided by the police. Mm-hmm. So that also interested me as well, just to find out, you know, from memoirs, what people were worried about and what they were scared about and how that reflected some of the activities they were engaged in later, such as the suffrage campaign.
So this is the other big thing that you've researched really a lot, isn't it? The suffragettes and the relationship between the suffragettes and jiu-jitsu. And I think, am I right in saying that the suffragettes, so the first person teaching anything like jiu-jitsu was Edward Barton Wright in London, and he had a school in central London, and he called it Bartitsu. And from that, several really integral characters to the suffragette movement were trained up. Is that right?
Well, it's interesting because there was a lecture in the very late 19th century in London to, I believe it was a Japan Society. So there were one or two obscure events where martial arts get mentioned, but it was really Barton Wright who actually brought that into the general consciousness, and especially his pieces that he wrote for the Pearson's magazine, quite long titles, you know, how you can defend yourself in any kind of situation, that kind of thing. And parts one and parts two, and then self-defense, the walking stick, part one and part two. And then he advertised his Bartitsu club, where a lot of the experts would come from around the world and teach, give various lessons, such as Pierre Vigny, who came came from Europe, you know, and his wife as well, who's actually described herself as Miss Sanderson, and she would also teach walking stick self-defense, as well as, you know, sort of parasol self-defense, fencing, and then you had, you know, people like Yuki Otani, Sadakazu Uyunishi, who were involved, and these were some of the Japanese assistants who came to help Barton Wright, who came to kind of, in a sense, popularize Bartitsu. But then they actually they moved away from him and his school, probably, we think, due to disputes over pay, or the way that they were represented by Barton Wright. You know, he would tour music halls and he would very much sort of use them as, oh, here are these, you know, interesting people demonstrating to you today these forms of entertainment. And I think they wanted to take a bit back for themselves. I think they wanted to own their own representations. So you have that lovely book by Sadakazu Uyanishi, where, you know, you've got photographs of himself, Edward Muybridge style, where you can see he's flying through the air in little snapshots, and he's presenting himself as dynamic. And, you know, it's really exciting, actually, to look at his book and the way that he presents himself, you know, to the British public as well, and both mixing in Japanese culture and British culture there as well through the pictures that he depicts. And it was really exciting, actually, as well, for me to go to the London Budokai for the first time a few months ago, because there you can see pictures of Yukio Tani, and it just sort of got in the building, and it's just thought, wow, you know, it's just really emotional to see this for the first time. So the picture of Yukio Tani, there's a description of him there as well, and then you can just see all these photographs of the whole history of the Budokai, you know, since 1918. And we've started learning karate a bit now, so my son's been sort of really into that. So we do these kind of meigeris up and down the living room, you know, not enough space or furniture, and we sort of do bash into a few things, but it's still fun just to actually be finally practicing a bit of martial arts, because it's something I always wanted to do, but I thought, I don't know if I'm any good at, you know, judo or something like that, but I've just got massively into karate at the moment, so we've got a lesson tomorrow.
Yeah, you're doing the Zoom lessons.
I know, it's good. It's sometimes the connection goes a bit, and it's like, okay, so put your left foot here and put your right arm there, and you're thinking, okay, what actually was it, right or left again? Because sometimes the connection will go when you don't hear everything very clearly, because we've got a terrible connection where we are. But generally, you can kind of sort of work it out just about from the picture when it sort of jumps about a bit. I was quite nervous doing my very first Zoom lesson, and so. I should be practicing my various kicks for tomorrow.
So in terms of your ongoing work, so you're talking about a new book on, is it Kitty and the Cats? Or
that's it, yes.
I think I've got a picture of a talk that you gave on that subject last year when we were still allowed to go out and about. Where is it?
Oh, I know. That's actually something I kind of miss, you know, just to be able to go to the London Library and do the research. Although they're actually really good, because they're offering people the opportunity to borrow books and actually to send books to people free of charge, which is great for researchers. So you can kind of keep your projects going, which is really helpful, and all the online resources too. So in a sense, while I miss that, I don't feel completely frustrated by the whole situation, because especially when you're writing and you're a writer, a lot of the time you kind of spend in self-isolation anyway.
So who was Kitty and who were the cats?
Right, well, Kitty Marshall, this was this lady here, and I'm hoping that you can see her. If I hold this up a little bit, oh my goodness. It's quite a big book. It's actually Christina Broome by Anna Sparham, and it's about suffragette photographs.
Yes.
Let's see if I can get her to focus. She is not on that.
Yeah, page. Well, yeah, that's good. That's looking good.
Okay, right. So, this is the thing, it's the coordination thing. Right, if I point to her.
Your sound's falling out a bit now.
The sound, okay.
Yeah. So, sound is crucial.
This is the curse of trying to get a huge book
at I can see that.
It's this lady here.
Yes. Yeah, I got it. Yeah.
Marshall wearing an 18th century mob cap, and you're probably wondering why she was wearing that, and that was actually a part of the suffragettes' kind of peaceful campaigns for raising money and funds for the Women's Social and Political Union. And, you know, one of the themes at that particular fair was to, in a sense, reference Mary Wollstonecraft and various powerful 18th century women writers. And that was one great way that they kind of felt that they could do that, by wearing 18th century costume. And Kitty was, she specialized in farm produce. So she decided to wear like a sort of farm kind of type mob cap.
So their identity was expressed by evoking a bygone age.
For that particular event. But what was actually really interesting around that time was that martial arts for women were really taking off. Mm-hmm. So Edith Garrard, at exactly that point, was promoting self-defense for women, and specifically for suffragettes. And around this time, Kitty was starting to become involved in the suffrage movement particularly, but also by, you know, learning martial arts. We don't know exactly when she started, but probably circa around 1912, 1913, because she became a member of the suffragette bodyguard that was given the task of protecting Mrs. Pankhurst from the police whenever she was pursued by the law enforcers to try and capture her, take her back to prison to make sure that she saw out the rest of her 3-year sentence. And one of Kitty's duties was to be in the bodyguard to protect Mrs. Pankhurst, but she was also a very good friend of hers too. So she's got an autobiography in the Museum of London where she describes her as dearest, you know, her close friend. And throughout her life, from the point where she met Mrs. Pankhurst until Mrs. Pankhurst's death, she was in a sense protecting her, not only physically from the police, but later on protecting her reputation by setting up the memorial to Mrs. Pankhurst in Victoria Tower Gardens that we see today. So, and also the Brompton Cemetery gravestone to Mrs. Pankhurst, and there was a portrait painted of her. So in a sense, she was very much protecting her. She was her bodyguard and her close friend, and she offered her place as a her home as a place for refuge for Mrs. Pankhurst when various things were going on in Mrs. Pankhurst's life, such as falling out with Sylvia Pankhurst and all of that. And Kitty's house kind of offered a refuge to her, so from the police and from publicity. And so she's a really interesting person to look at in terms of not only martial arts history, but the history of the suffrage movement too.
Okay, so are there documents that or letters, or is there just a kind of popular memory of the first time that the suffragettes decided that they needed to be trained in self-defense? Because I know they would sometimes carry weapons, they would carry Indian clubs and things, wouldn't they, that they could conceal up their sleeves or in their coats, and when the police or when the mob or whoever it was would try to arrest them, they would batter them with that. But then did it develop from clubs to a more refined approach to training and self-defense, or is there a process that we know about?
Well, it's interesting because like the press referred to these Indian clubs as rolling pins because people who weren't in the know, but you could tell that these were clearly bodyguard armed with their Indian clubs. Well, I think one of the big turning points for the suffrage movement, particularly, you know, the Women's Social and Political Union, was Black Friday, which was 18th of November 1910. And that was a huge confrontation that took place in Westminster outside the Houses of Parliament. And there's a group of women and they wanted to send a deputation to Parliament, and they were blocked by the police. And there were lots of really horrible examples of what went on there for hours and hours, how the women were mishandled without, you know, being basically they're kind of, in a sense, let, you know, kept at the mercy of the police for a long, long time rather than just simply being arrested. And then there was this idea that, you know, women shouldn't be using their bodies anymore, you know, to make themselves vulnerable. They should be using things like stones, you know, smashing windows. And that was the first kind of shift there, because it was just too dangerous, you know, to kind of risk their safety in that sense. And then also, I think later on, when you had more confrontations with the police, again, you had the sort of need for martial arts training too. So even if there was a deputation that was meant to be peaceful, it could, you know, spill out into something. So I think people at Edith Garrard were offering
connection.
It's the opportunity to arm themselves for things that they may or may not be able to, you know, predict that could go wrong.
Okay. And did
the signal went out there just slightly? So
just slightly. No, I think we got about 99% of that. So it's all that's okay. Let's fingers crossed that that the connection stays with us for a while. So did they actively seek out martial arts training, or did they already like know these people? Did they know the people who trained them, or did they look for them?
Well, Edith Garrard advertised in various women's suffrage periodicals. So, you know, you would have, you know, her club being mentioned there. As soon as, you know, you would be perusing, you know, like the Vote or Women's Social and Political Union magazine, Votes for Women or the Suffragette, you would see, Madame Garrard's Jiu-Jitsu School. And I think also she got a fair amount of publicity in the press too, because there were these various confrontations between her and a would-be policeman, and that was discussed and actually described in great detail, you know, how high she was, how small she was, you know, how high the policeman was, you know, way over 6 foot, and she managed to throw him to the ground. There was only really one confrontation, one of these sort of made-up confrontations that I sort of saw. Some of them weren't made up, some of them were actually real, but they kind of, in a sense, there was this set up to them. There was very much this idea that, okay, this is a stage for Edith to show off what she can do. There's only one confrontation where she was felled to the ground, but even then, you know, it was still very, you know, very good humoured. And I found it was kind of interesting because a lot of the time there was this idea that, you know, you had suffragettes versus the police, but I think there was a lot more understanding there and a lot more kind of cooperation than you would think. So after, for instance, that jiu-jitsu confrontation, you know, Edith would get back up again, you know, they'd sort of bow, you know, they'd shake hands or whatever and smile, and that was it. Whereas I think a lot of the time scholarship, you know, kind of mentions the confrontational aspect, and there were a lot of officers, and this is one thing I look at, specific memoirs that haven't been published before and pretty much never seen the light of day, where they actually talk about being very sympathetic to the women's cause, and how, for instance, you know, the Cat and Mouse Act, where women were released from prison to recover from their hunger striking in order to be clawed back again, time and time again, weakening them. Officers actually just thought that was just a crazy piece of legislation. I mean, Reginald McKenna, who was really the architect of that particular act, he kept on defending it all the time, saying, well, how else do we, you know, deal with women whose crimes are very, very serious? And we can't, you know, let them die in prison, but, you know, we also can't just completely release them. But the police thought this was a crazy idea because they knew that the women, very intelligent women, as the police actually mentioned in the memoirs, they're not going to fall for that. You know, they're not going to go willingly back to jail again. You know, they're going to do everything they can to stay out and, you know, create more havoc and more fires and arson attempts and things like that. So, you know, some of the people that Kitty knew and she was friendly with, you know, did try to start fires and, you know, damage various items. I think Kitty didn't do that much in the way of window damage. She did a bit. I think she mainly confined it to that, and also protesting against the census. So there's this lovely story where she and Arthur Marshall, her husband, who was a lawyer and also defended suffragettes in court, where they would hire three caravans and then they'd sort of go off, you know, and go to like Wimbledon Common and just sort of hang out there during the census protest. And sort of say, you know, we do not want to be counted. We're off somewhere else, you know, we're having fun here. So there were lots of really peaceful things that Kitty did as well as defend Mrs. Pankhurst. And I think it's mainly stone throwing. So she didn't go in for the more extreme forms of attack, if you like.
So you think that, for instance, a film like Suffragette, which was, what, 2015 or something?
I think it was around 2013.
2013, okay. So, yeah, that'd probably be right.
No, was it 2013?
I think maybe that's
no, I think it might be right. It could be 2015 or 2016. Yeah, it was around that time.
It was kind of around the centenary, wasn't it? So it was a bit. It was. I can't remember
exactly. Before.
I think I don't know, but maybe it came out on DVD or whatever, or streaming around that time. But that, I mean, do you think that gives an accurate, in any way, an accurate account of it, or did you find that a problematic film?
Well, on one hand, I found there were certain aspects that were really bang on accurate. So the idea, you know, you had Maud, who was the washerwoman, represented as the main character there rather than, you know, a lady. And there was this theme about, you know, suffragettes and washing. And I think there was an A to Z that was put together. And, you know, they say it was a suffragette A to Z of all the various sort of letters in the alphabet. And W is for washing. It's all about sort of women's work and suffrage campaigning. It's a little sort of cute little book that was put together. And I kind of like that sort of nod to that kind of suffragette propaganda there in the film. And I thought that Maud was really sympathetic. And also, you know, some of the characters around her, though, again, yeah, I think Edith Garrett is interesting because she does actually pop up indirectly in the film, because Helena Bonham Carter was said to be inspired by Edith Garrett, so she actually wanted to call her particular character, who is one of the more extreme characters, after Edith. So there was a kind of real nod to, you know, real life there, which I quite liked actually. But on the other hand, as regards the police, it was really interesting because Arthur Steed, who was one of the it was like a kind of special branch type, Sir Patrick Quinn type of figure, and he was the head of the special branch. And he was kind of based on Sir Patrick Quinn, and he was sympathetic to a point. So, you know, he sort of said that what they were doing was dangerous and, you know, they could have injured people. And that was a very good point. But then some of the vocabulary he comes out with as well, you think, oh no, he's not particularly nice guy in the end, you know. And mm-hmm. and he was the best representative of the police force. The rest of it is just, you know, again, helmets, mm-hmm. Mustaches, anonymous mm-hmm. figures, you know, with truncheons. And in that kind of sense, I thought, oh, it's kind of perpetuating this idea again that the police officers, you know, that they weren't human beings, that they didn't have a, you know, they actually had a job to do, and they had, you know, a lot of them were sympathetic to what the women were campaigning for. And I think that wasn't really reflected in the film there. And I'm hoping that with this book here, you know, Kitty and the Cats, because the Cats is, you know, it was short for police officers, the authorities.
Okay.
And I'm hoping that that kind of brings out their voices a bit as well.
So you're suggesting there's two things. So on the one hand, you seem to be suggesting that there wasn't a simple polarity between suffragettes and police,
yeah,
and that it was that there were a lot more complex kind of sympathies and allegiances and strategies. And then also you seem to have suggested earlier that the suffragettes had a kind of a PR campaign, and they used jiu-jitsu as a kind of staging of their own image. And it reminds me of some of the accusations that were leveled against, you know, remember the Guardian Angels in New York in the 1980s. And there was a lot, there were accusations that sometimes they staged interventions, like they would set up, they would have a criminal, you know, like striped jumper and a mask and a swag.
Hooligan from the 1900s, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and so like it's like an early kind of staging of a publicity stunt. Do you remember that term? And it's like, yeah. So they're kind of saying, look, these presumably little women can drop this big policeman, and you get the famous images of women with men with police officers with their arms up their back.
Yeah,
you know, you're saying that a lot of that may have been staged for publicity reasons, or that was the public image they wanted to put out there.
Yeah, I think that was a public image, but the reality could be kind of different. So there was one particular confrontation where these rolling pins appeared, the Indian clubs, so to speak, a bodyguard confrontation. And the press actually said that, and this is also borne out in police memoirs of the time, that one woman tried to attack a police officer, defend her friend against a police officer. She ended up, unfortunately, hitting another one of the members of the bodyguard, who then sort of got covered in blood and had to get, you know, had to be sort of taken off to get stitches. But so in reality, these kind of self-defense scenarios may have been less than smooth.
Yeah.
But again, the fact that women were offered the potential to study martial arts and to learn martial arts and to give themselves confidence. And I think, you know, I have kind of differing responses to Edith Garrett, because on the one hand, you know, she is a bit of a heroine, but I've also heard from her descendants that, you know, she could literally arm wrestle you into a jiu-jitsu kind of confrontation, as in literally, would you like to learn martial arts? Okay, I'm going to twist your arm right now. And one of her granddaughters said to me, no, I'm not into that kind of thing. So in a sense, she could be really, you know, quite difficult in a way as well, and quite bossy probably. But that kind of personality was probably quite essential for that kind of role, as wasn't in fact Mrs. Pankhurst too. I mean, she can be quite bossy too. So you know, the way that she talked to Sylvia in the letters, no, you cannot call it the East London Federation of the Suffragettes. That's not a good title, because people will think the Women's Social and Political Union and the East London Federation are connected. No, Sylvia, you're so difficult, you know. So in a sense, Mrs. Pankhurst could kind of talk down to people as well, and she could be bossy too. And obviously Christabel, you know, who was very much sort of running the kind of sort of show once Mrs. Pankhurst was in and out of jail. She was running the show from Paris. But again, you know, this is an idea that they were these really strong and potentially difficult women at the helm. And I think Edith Garrard was probably one of those as well.
Okay, it interests me that, I mean, if you know some grappling, if you know some how to put people in arm locks and how to drop them and how to tie them up, it's almost irresistible to want to teach that to children. Go here, come over here. And there's famous stories about like the Gracie family in Brazil, and it would be like, you know, Uncle Helio or whatever, going, just, you know, have a bit of fun. Why not try and do that? You and your brother, get there and just... And it's like, I think any parent or uncle or auntie who knows that, you want to give that gift to your young relatives and friends, don't you? I mean,
I suppose, whereas her granddaughter just ran away, she said to me, "No, I don't want to know."
Yeah, I mean, so you've chosen karate for you and your son, I guess, at the moment. So you did self-defense, got you interested in this whole thing, and you were a Victorian literature scholar, and you were like, "Oh, this is, I'm going to dig into this." But now you have a young son who's interested in martial arts, and you've chosen like Shotokan karate, haven't you, rather than...
Well, it's a bit weird because the first time we went to the Budokai, they said, okay, it's actually, you can join any of the karate drop-in classes, you know, so your son can join a beginner's class. Whereas with judo, you have to sign up for, I think it's something like 8 weeks in a row. So that's quite a commitment. And when you're living pretty much a 2 kind of hour journey from the Budokai, that's a pretty long journey on a Saturday. Yeah. But you know, so we thought we'd start off with the karate, but he really would like to learn judo. He's always talking about judo. Yeah. So I think that's something that's going to be on the horizon. So if we start off with the karate, then potentially you can do the judo afterwards, because I have heard that some kids, you know, go on from one class and then straight on to the other one on a Saturday. It depends on how committed he is. Mm. But he'll suddenly start up doing martial arts at 9:30 at night. I don't know why, you know, around 9 o'clock is our karate hour, but that's when things seem to happen. That's when your upper blocks seem to start happening in the house, you know, and knife hand blocks and things. But yeah, I'd like him to learn the Shotokan. At the moment, he's learning Shitoryu locally, so we're going to see how that kind of works out, so combining the two. So I've got various sort of moves to learn for both of them, but I kind of like elements of both. So, you know, when you're watching Shotokan compared to Shitoryu, say on YouTube, there's actually I think it's one of the kata that was shown, and you could really sort of see, you know, the cat stance was the Shitoryu version, and the knife hand block, the Kokutsudachi, the back stance, was the Shotokan take on that. And it was just really fascinating to watch, you know, the two martial arts, you know, experts kind of, in a sense, having a bit of a sort of dialogue there. The two
were you never tempted to look into a classical, like traditional jiu-jitsu, so that you could think about the you know, the kind of something close to what the Victorians would have encountered, something that Edith Garrard might have learned? Because historically it was a kind of jiu-jitsu first. So there was Bartitsu, which then, I guess, Barton Wright was a bit of a control freak, right? And he wanted everything to come to him and everything to go through him.
Yeah.
And then he popularized this by, you know, working with lots of Japanese martial artists. And then the term became jiu-jitsu, but then that was washed away by judo. Woof. Mm. Judo became the massive force through most of the 20th century. And then it was only really in the 70s when you got your karate and then kung fu. And so, I mean, have you never been tempted to kind of go, I wonder what it would be like to learn the kind of classical jiu-jitsu that Sherlock Holmes might have learnt, or Barton Wright might have learnt, or Edith Garrard might have learnt?
Yeah, I've gone to various conferences and various events where somebody has specialised in martial arts and read Barton Wright's work and then kind of interpreted it and sort of taken part in various events. But I always had this sort of secret fear that, oh, you know, my coordination's not great. You know, I can't follow when somebody opposite me is standing on the left foot. You know, I'm going left foot, right foot, oh, yeah. No. And even, you know, with the karate Zoom class, you know, last week I was thinking, okay, so we had our back to him at that point, you know, and we were sort of doing our punching forward. And I was thinking, okay, which leg do I do this and that with? And I've always had a bit of a sort of secret fear of that, you know, kind of being at the back of the aerobics class where all of us were completely confused. Nobody knew what was going on at the front, but, you know. And I kind of have memories of that, and I thought, oh, I don't know if I'd be any good at doing that. But I think, yeah, I'd be kind of curious. But for some reason, I don't know why karate seems to massively appeal to me. I think it's because you can do it in your own time. And there are lots of really good Shotokan videos on YouTube, some really good teachers who explain it very slowly. And you can sort of teach yourself the Heian Shodan in slow motion and sort of go, okay, right, you know, sort of like striking there and going forward. And that for me, in a sense, is easier to learn than in a class where everybody is sort of falling all over the place and, you know, doing left and right and coordinating this and that. And but I think if I get more confidence with the karate, I think that might be something that I might think about, especially if, you know, my son wants to learn judo. I think I'm going to sort of be pulled into that. I think it's pretty much inevitable.
I would warn you against judo. I don't know how old you are, but God, I think that the window closes for judo quite early and your body gets smashed to pieces. But something that doesn't involve principally being slammed into the floor over and over again.
Oh, gosh, oh no.
So when will we see Kitty and the Cats? What's the output? When's the book published? What's happening with the...
So I've sent the edits of the manuscript to my publisher a couple of days ago. Thank goodness. Mm-hmm. What happened was it turned into a huge book, and then it kind of became slimmer and slimmer and slimmer. So initially it was sort of all these great things I found. And the thing is, especially you get really emotionally involved in it, then you can't not put all the things in that you find. But then you have to kind of take things out and go, well, actually, I don't need to put so much in terms of suffragette general history there, because people can look at other books on that one. So I've taken a lot of these things out. So it's really imminent. It's been about imminent for about a year now, but particularly now, though, because we have cut it down a huge amount. So I've taken out anything that interrupts the story, because it's mainly going to be a story rather than, an academic book now. And it's got a lot of action scenes in it. You know, it opens with a bodyguard confrontation. And a lot of it's on the ground research and sort of finding out the stories behind the buildings where, you know, and the streets where some of these particular encounters took place. I've got a lot of interviews as well with people that are living relatives, you know, of some of the officers and suffragettes who were involved. So a lot of that's going to sort of go towards making a story, and rather than actually having the academic material in there, which is now pretty much largely gone, it's now going to be the actual story of it, but based entirely on every single word that was said. So it's got a strong academic basis, but it's going to be narrative. I've not made up a single thing, you know.
So maybe you should look at sending the academic stuff to our journal. Yeah.
I've got plenty of stuff. I've just deleted about 150 pages worth of material. So I've got, oh, I could use that for this. I could use it for this, you know. So
yeah, you haven't deleted it. You've moved it.
I've moved it. Yeah, it's going to be kind of on the sort of back burner for the future project.
All right. Okay. Well, Emmeline, it was wonderful to speak to you again. It was lovely to see you. thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Send us the stuff to the journal, definitely.
Cool. Yep. I've got various bits on the confrontation in St. Andrew's Hall in 1914, which is a big bodyguard confrontation, so I can send some things on that.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Cool. Thank you.